This is G'day World 264, talking with Dr. Peter Elliard.
We have a legacy of freedom and privilege, which has been won by hard struggle, hasn't been given by from above. It's been won, but we have it, and we can use that to help people who are suffering seriously if we try.
Well, the singularity is a future time which will be profoundly transformative, where the machine intelligence we're creating will be billions of times more powerful than our own biological intelligence.
Well, I ask you, what's next for Robert Scoble? What do you think you're going to be doing 3-4 years from now?
Oh, geez. Well, hopefully we'll have a successful launch of Longhorn. I want to stick around with Microsoft for at least 4 more years.
Around what I call the because effect rather than the with effect. In other words, I can make more money because of my blog than with
anything
my blog.
Of this magnitude only happens because enormous numbers of people want it to happen and are willing to commit time and energy and money.
Now it is. G'day everyone. It's Cameron, obviously. It's the 11th of July, 2007. I'm sitting in a little cafe in South Yarra in Melbourne with my friend Dr. Peter Elliard. Hello, Dr. Peter.
Hello, Cameron. How are you?
I'm frustrated. I'm cranky. I'm annoyed. I'm undecidedly impressed with myself today. I don't feel like I'm having a big enough impact. I don't feel like I'm contributing enough. Oh, here's our soy chai lattes have just arrived. And you said to me when I came into your house, best thing, you said to me, something like, I feel that way too sometimes. Visionaries always feel that way. Their reach exceeds their grasp. Is that what it is?
Their dreams. Look, the future is part visionary and part prophet. We talked about that before. But it's also part fairy godmother about having dreams and making them come true, which sometimes is very hard to make them come true. And even though you can be a very good strategist and set out and make them come true, you actually find all sorts of roadblocks, and it's money or people or power. And we always seem to be so Mickey Mouse in our achievements compared with our aspirations. Now, that's a sure way to be disappointed. But I don't think it's a bit disappointed in oneself to be disappointed in one's inability to be effective. And I remember Maurice Strong, who was the Secretary General of the Earth Summit in 1992, and I was working with him on the Climate Change Convention, Framework Convention, and we had a very hard time getting that through, and a lot of people pronounced the thing as a failure. And Maurice said to me, Peter, we now have to redouble our efforts to get there. And I've never forgotten that, because he said, all you have to do is be smarter and try harder, but particularly smarter. Understand why you're not achieving things, why you're not getting the results you want, and there are reasons for it, and there are very practical reasons for it. Sometimes you've got the wrong strategy. Sometimes you are not reading people as you think they ought to be. There's all sorts of reasons, but simple fact is you actually don't throw the vision away. You review the journey there, and you say, well, I just have to think differently in a different way, and if I try to achieve the result by a different way. And so I think a sense of failure, which is what you're feeling, is the greatest teacher. We all know that.
Well, somebody, a friend of mine, referred to it this morning as inspirational dissatisfaction. And that's exactly how I feel. It's like I'm cranky, not at the world, it's at myself. I don't feel like I'm achieving enough, fast enough. I'm not contributing enough to my country, my society, the world, as much as I want to be contributing. And it's only, I've only got myself to blame for that. So I come through these things thinking, okay, what can I do to increase my reach, increase my contribution? How can I work smarter? How can I work harder? Smarter rather than harder, I think, is usually the story.
Well, I think the important thing is to think about not kicking goals now, but reflecting on 20 years after you're dead and you're in your grave.
No,
just hit me out. My grandchildren and your great-grandchildren are standing beside your grave on your birthday, thinking about you. How are they remembering you? In other words, ultimately, this is about a legacy. Fame and celebrities are people who are very famous in their lifetime, but actually don't do very much, right? Fame is something which accrues slowly and to those who are deserve it, because ultimately it's about legacy. Some people become living legends. They become legacies in their own life, legends in their own life.
We're surrounded by Picasso paintings here. Picasso, one of the very few artists who was famous and wealthy in his lifetime.
Because he broke all the ground rules, didn't he?
Several times.
And that's what he did. So, I think it's important to think about a life journey, not just a short journey, and to think about leaving legacies all the way through. And as you become wiser and you understand the world better, you become better. So, when you're your age, you try hard, but your skill sets are not as great as they're going to be when you're 50 or when you're 70. So ultimately, you can be more effective later on because you actually understand how to operate. And I remember one particular man told me once that when I was in a great hurry, and he said, and redoubling your efforts, he said, well, look, some things take time. There's a thing called gestation. Four people can't make a baby in 4.5 months, can they? Some things just take time, and you have to wait and understand. So wisdom's really about when trying harder and redoubling your efforts makes a difference, and when actually doing nothing makes a difference. Because sometimes you have to wait for your moment in time when you can move forward, when there's an acceptance of climate, but you've got it all set up to go. And trying a year earlier means that you hit against a wall, bang your head against a wall.
So let's talk about World Parliament. I mentioned to you earlier I've been reading this book by George Monbiot, I'm not sure how he pronounces that, called The Age of Consent, and it reflects a lot of stuff that I've heard you say and read in your books about, you know, the rise of planetism and how we need to start letting go of our identification with a particular geographical region and saying, well, we are Australians, and start thinking about the fact that we are members of this thing called the human race that lives on the planet Earth, and thinking about what is in the best interests of the species and the planet. He talks about the need for a world democracy, a world parliament where every person on the planet has one equal vote, and talks about, you know, the way that some of our international bodies today, the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, and particularly the UN Security Council, are by no means democratic institutions. They are run by the wealthy countries for the benefit of the wealthy countries.
And a lot of the members are dictators. Are dictatorships. A lot of the member countries are dictatorships. Well, look, I mean, what George Monbiot said about the arrival of planetism, well, we have tribalism, which is well and truly gone, although some of that's still present in Africa and places. We have nationalism, first priority to tribe. The next one is what I call planetism, which is first priority to planet. Now, a lot of the people listening to this broadcast will be regarding themselves as planetists now, because they say, well, if I come have a choice between my allegiance to nation or planet, well, for example, over climate change, in our country we have a country that's not wanting to cooperate with the Kyoto Protocol, I get very angry about that. I say, well, but how about the planet? And it's just bigger. And the example I use all the time is liking smoking in a cafe today. When you smoke in a cafe, you do collateral damage to people in the cafe. So we ban smoking in cafes. Now, in 20 years' time, smoking on the planet will be the same, because the atmosphere is just a rather larger cafe. And we'll be doing collateral damage to people all over the world by smoking on the planet. So in 20 years' time, no greenhouse gases will be released to the Earth. Anybody who does it will be regarded with the same hostility as a person smoking at a next table in a cafe today or in an airliner. So that's an emerging ethic. And that what that means is that you're transporting your understanding of the locality, of the local, into your understanding of the planetary. And you say, well, there's no difference really. It's just one of size and dilution, because the old adage of early people who took on pollution was that the solution to pollution is dilution.
Say that again.
The solution to pollution is dilution.
What do they mean by dilution?
Well, we dilute all the mess in the planet because it's a big receiver. You can take lots of it. We can keep on smoking, you see, because it's such a big place, whereas a cafe is a small place, and therefore we get negative feedback. The concentration of smoke goes up quicker.
Yep.
Well, the concentration of smoke is going up in the planets now, and we're getting climate change. So the principles are the same. So an ethic of 2020 about will be, thou shalt not smoke on the planet at all. And if you do, you'll be fined or punished by perhaps a global governance or global parliament, which comes back to what George is saying about global governance, but not necessarily government. We already have global governance. We have conventions on all sorts of things which say we agree to do things. Now, that's a way... So we have evolving global governance today where countries come together and agree that they stop trafficking in drugs, or they can limit their greenhouse gases, or put a ban on landmines, or stop polluting the ocean, or whatever it's going to be. And we set up an international criminal court, which is to punish the planetary wicked when they're bad. They're planetary wicked people. We have set up the planetary system, the court system, which is evolving. So we're creating the process of planetary governance now in huge amounts. It's like a country like Australia or America, which consists of either 6 states and 2 territories or 50 states. And if we didn't have a central government in Washington and Canberra, if all the states pass identical laws, we would have the same net result, wouldn't we? We can get governance. We don't need a central government to get global governance. It just takes... It's more cumbersome and slower, but we can get it. Now, that's the stage we're at now. Now, I actually think it's going to take a while to get world government, particularly on one vote, one value, because that means that little countries like Australia just don't get a hearing at all, irrespective of their power. So,
but that's reasonable, though, isn't it? That's what democracy...
Well, traditionally, we've come around that way. In the US and Australia, for example, to name those two countries, we have a House of Representatives, which is one vote, one value, but the upper house is equality between the states. And in America, each state, irrespective of whether it's Kentucky or New York or Rhode Island, has 2 senators. In Australia, we have these 6 states, each with 10 senators. And little Tasmania has 10 senators, just like big New South Wales or Victoria does. So we have other ways of dealing with the situation. That's what 2 tiers... So we could probably have that situation. We could have one vote, one value in lower house, and we could have an upper house consisting of the nations of the planet who have equal representatives in the upper house of the planet, with one senator each for one whatever. And that would provide and it has to get through both parliaments.
We already have the United Nations, which has, you know, one representative from each country.
Well, that has one representative from China and one representative from Liechtenstein or Samoa.
Yeah.
And now, the Chinese probably think that's not a terribly good deal.
It's not representative of their population.
No.
Yeah.
No. So, and ultimately, but of course then the Chinese are different because they have one vote on the Security Council. But a country like, which is big like India, does not. India has, you know, 1 billion people plus.
A fifth of the world's population, but doesn't even have a seat on the UNSC, a permanent seat on the UNSC.
That's right. Right. So those are the inadequacies. Now, I'm very happy to work on global governance. Let's have lots of conventions. Let's sign them up. The World Trade Organization, the Climate Change Convention, blah, blah. All those. And over time, we will have planetary governance, which will be quite effective, but which means that there'll be all sorts of rules. For example, we're going to have some rules which are going to tell how people can invest in other places, in other countries, and what rules they can withdraw money and invest in money. We'll probably have rules cover things like corruption over time. I mean, there's a whole lot of things we can have new rules on, which we don't quite have yet, and that's continuing now. So the world government will probably be the last step, you know, the penultimate step of world governance. But what goes on prior to that is huge, and actually even more significant than having a world government, which will, I think, be the last piece of the puzzle to go into place, and that might be 30, 40 years away.
Monbiot is suggesting that the first step is to have a world parliament where the people don't actually have any power, doesn't have any authority or any power apart from a moral authority, to say this is what the people of the world think, this is what the people of the world want, and to use that to exert a certain amount of moral authority on these other international organisations which have a lot of power and a lot of control, and it's going to be very difficult to wrest that away from them. But the first step is to at least have an alternative body that is representative of the people of the world, where they have a voice and they can at least stand up and have a vote, a genuine vote on what they want to see happen with the planet. Whereas today, I think he refers to it as a photocopy democracy. How, you know, we vote for... The people select their local representative, and then that representative represents them at a state or a federal or an international level, but each time it gets watered down a little bit from what the people really want.
Yeah. Well, that's a representative democracy is distinct from a participatory democracy. Theoretically, you could have a... With modern technology, you can have representative. Everyone has their mobile phone. You just press a button, and the world votes in 1 minute.
Yep.
And you wouldn't even have to collect them together. An internet plebiscite on almost every issue.
Yeah. Or at least the big issues.
No, the big issues. Yeah. The point about that is, and even representative democracy is probably is going, because representative democracy meant we had no practical way of having everyone vote on every issue. But now we have the technology to do that. And maybe we don't need representative democracy at all, representatives to members of parliament even. We could actually have a situation where the whole world votes at the UN, in the existing UN system, on an issue.
The problem being that most of us don't feel educated enough about the issues to know what decisions we should make. And we hope that our representatives are well educated in the affairs, they have their advisors, they spend time thinking about what should be
but
done.
They're also often corrupt too, so there's two sides to that, right?
Yeah, which is and then we have I was doing a show last night about the Military Commissions Act of 2006 in the United States, which is basically enabling them to build these concentration camps around the United States at the moment. And the vote was taken in Congress just before the elections happened.
That's
and the
right.
Democrats got it. One of the senior Democrats from Ohio, I was reading an interview with him last night, he voted for this Military Commissions Act. And when he was interviewed recently and asked, why did you do it? He said, oh, look, you know, there was campaign pressures. It was a bad vote. I regret having voted for it. But at the time, we felt we had to vote for it, or the political implications. Yeah, so there's bad votes happening for bizarre reasons, you know, by our representatives.
Well, that happens all the time. Because, I mean, right now, our fear of terrorism is such that we are probably taking too many human rights away from individuals. Right now here in Australia, as we speak, we have this fellow in jail who hasn't been charged for anything. He's been kept there for a week already, no charges, and he may not be even be charged, simply because they think he's got some information and they want to get it out of him and work out whether he's tied with these terrorists who just tried to blow up the buildings in London and Glasgow. Now, a lot of people are saying this is unfair. There's a thing called habeas corpus, which says that you should not be imprisoned without being charged. I mean, there are issues around that. And this guy's been imprisoned without it being charged. So there are great traditions at stake here. But that what happens is when the fear reigns, people do often extreme things, and we finish up with more extreme forms of governance than we would have if the system were not as... the overall environment was not as threatening. So that's part of what goes on. Look, global governance is essential to manage this planet because it is one single entity. And in my work, I point out that we're probably 50, 60% there already without really recognising it. And the International Criminal Court, the World Trade Organization, said the rules of trade, new rules for investment.
But the ICC is toothless tiger because countries like the United States won't sign up to it. The World Trade Organization is run by the wealthy countries for their own benefit.
Well, let's talk about both of those. Let's talk about the IPCC and the climate change issue. Right now, John Howard in Australia and George Bush in America, who are two people who stood out against Kyoto, are both losing ground and credibility in this issue. the next president of the United States, even if it's a Republican, will sign the Kyoto Protocol, in my view. And the next Prime Minister of Australia, Labor or Liberal, if it's Costello or Ruddock, they will both sign it. Will both sign it. And that's already over. These people are dinosaurs, just living beyond. The world has passed them by, and the positions of both of them is less credible, just as the same as the positions on Iraq have become less and less credible by the passage of time. Now, once they led a majority, and now they're leading small minorities, and they're so frozen in their positions that we actually need to throw these people out and replace them with people who can think differently, because these people will go to their political execution unchanged, because they think they would lose too much face by changing. And so that's the issue there. And the world climate of public opinion, which is the educated middle class of the world, is moving on. And the educated middle class of the world believes in democracy, a clean environment, two children, and mass education. And the world middle class now, the educated middle class, are close to 2 billion people. 500 million in China plus India alone. And educated middle class people think the same way. And they are the people, the values of the educated middle class, who by and large are planetists, because they actually have enough education to think about that. So we have to protect this planetary home of ours. And they are driving the world public opinion. They're the people who own all the shares in all the big companies. They own all the media companies. I mean, the middle-class people, in all their form, actually are a huge process for planetary good at the moment. I know most people think that they're greedy and selfish and self-indulgent. Well, they are. Middle-class people have always been into aspirations. Whether it's a sex change operation or plastic surgery or higher education, they've always been self-indulgent, but they're also becoming altruistic, because they also have enough income to want to volunteer, to spend money to put Indonesia back after the tsunami or repair damage around the world.
What do you think lies at the bottom of that? When something like a tsunami happens in Indonesia, what is it about an event like that that makes us become more altruistic than we would be typically?
Well, a long time ago, in 1620 to be precise, John Donne wrote a famous poem, and that poem goes like this: "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is part of a continent, part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as much as if a promontory were, as much as the estate of mine own or my friends were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never sent to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." He was the world's first planetist, 1620. Now, we're all planetists. Now, when I say that poem to you, that means I'm concerned about the people of Indonesia. I don't know them. I'm concerned about famine in Africa. We're all, no man is an island entire of itself. Everyone is part of the continent, part of the main. Just take out continent and put planet, part of the main. 400 years ago, he said that. Now, that's the most prophetic piece of writing I know in the world. And the whole world, and that is now the conscience, the consciousness and the conscience both of 21st century planet amongst educated middle class people, particularly because they can afford to think about these issues. They're not struggling with where the next meal's coming from. But globalisation is creating more and more educated middle class people every year. I mean, the growth in India, the middle class in India plus China each year in the middle class is the population of Australia, 20 million. Okay? Now, those people are changing the values of the planet, and they're all basically saying the other part is the old rich. Let me talk about that story. Rich people, the first generation is often the great entrepreneur. The second generation is often quite selfish and self-indulgent and often spend some of their inheritance. The third generation with what's left say, well, I don't have to work for a living. I've got tons of money. But my kids walk down the street, they get beaten up by somebody who's got no money, who's on drugs. What I have to do is now spend my money not looking after my own, but making sure those kids who are on drugs, who are poor, live in a world so my own child is safe.
And yet we see Jamie Packer going and buying casinos in Macau with his third generation.
That is true, but he's He's not educated. He's a middle class, but not educated.
Campbell, he's a Geelong grammar boy, isn't he?
Well, that doesn't mean he went to school. I don't know how many books James Packer reads.
Mostly Playboy magazines, I think, from the women he ends up dating.
But let's assume that he wouldn't be actually reading the sort of books that you read or I read. Now, that sounds like a sense of arrogance and superiority, but the simple fact is we have the world views of what we are because of our parents, our society, and what we read.
He's a Scientologist, though.
What?
He's a Scientologist by some accounts.
Well, I don't know whether he's a Scientologist.
What's your view on Scientology? Do you have one?
Well, Scientology is a facile... I mean, it only became a church simply because it wanted to avoid taxes. You know that, don't you?
Good reason. Yeah. I'm thinking about becoming a church.
Well,
we could worship you. You could become, our spiritual leader.
That's a great thought. I quite like that. but the chicks,
fast cars. It's a good thing, dude.
Lots of gambling. They came to church to avoid taxes, and the fact is that Ron Hubbard's ideas are crazy. Now, that doesn't mean there's always some value in anything. And I'm always pleased that somebody has a spiritual direction of some sort, even if I don't agree with it. If it's fundamentalist Islamic or fundamentalist something else, and they believe in killing the other side, I'm not agreeing with it. But if it's a middle class view, it means I have my views, and I'm not going to actually harm anybody else. And so I don't think if that has a core for their reasoning, I don't object to that. But there's also, and this is what freaks out the political right today, is they talk about that the Kyoto Protocol and the Green Revolution is a form of religion. They use that, the political right say that all the time, don't they? Well, there's a sense, when James Lovelock talked about Gaia, the simple fact is there is evolving sort of spiritual connection with the planet. You can call it a religion. It's not a religion, but it's a spiritual connection. It's about the awesomeness and divineness of the planet and our need to collectively protect our planetary home. And that's a high level of spirituality and a high level of awareness. Now, I think that's fantastic myself. And irrespective of whether I have... The only people who are against that are the fundamentalists who are so locked into their dogma, whether it's Islamic or Christian or Buddhist or Hindu, it doesn't matter. They're locked into their own dogma.
Or Keynesian.
Or Keynesian. But they're locked into their own dogma of one sort, and they actually don't see the spirituality of the grandness of the universe, of the planet. And because, so the point about that is that famous photograph of Apollo 8 started the whole, kickstarted the whole thing.
Al Gore was in his film, yeah.
Yeah, this famous Earthrise photograph, as it's called, it was the beginning of the environmental revolution because he saw this beautiful blue and white fragile planet.
Which was 69. You said your first environmental
68.
Job?
68,
was it? Your first environmental job was...
67, actually, it was.
The moon landing was 69.
No, that's right. Well, that's right. 69 was Henry Skip Jackson's NEPA Act in America, which is the first big National Environment Policy Act in the world, passed through the Senate, the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives, which set to create the concept of impact statement. All started when people saw this beautiful blue and white fragile... There were two things. The blue and white fragile planet... hanging in the blackness of space, beautiful and fragile, but in the foreground, a lifeless moonscape, by contrast. Contrast between life and death at that moment was visible and instantaneous. We saw our planetary home as tribal, national people had never seen it. The planetism grew from that point on, and John Donne's perception all those years ago started to pick up adherence. Today, I would say there's 2 billion of us around the world, and we're in another 5 to 10 years, we will be the planetary majority.
Let me go back to something you said earlier, which really struck a chord with me. When you were talking about Howard and Bush being on their way out, I've got a sense... I spoke to Paul Gilding,
yes.
who is going to be on the show, hopefully, in the next few days. I was speaking to him a month or so ago and asked him the question, why is it that we've seen Bush and Howard start to soften their rhetoric in the last 6 months? Is it because of Al Gore's film? What is it? And he said, well, look, Gore's film played its role, but he said the big thing is that the businesses these political leaders meet with have started to change their position, and that follows on to the politicians. When the big corporations say, well, you know what, we are starting to realise the impact that this is going to have on our profits and our share price, and
So we need to start to take action. That's when the political leaders change. And, you know, I'm cynical enough about our two-party political system to think that it doesn't really matter if it's Liberal or Labor or the Republicans or the Democrats. At the end of the day, they're both reliant to a very large extent on the goodwill of large corporations, on the goodwill of the Rupert Murdochs of the world. And it's those guys that really set the direction of a lot of the major political parties. But you made the point before that the middle class actually controls a significant...
They own all the shares.
Shares, but we don't...
And they're all the directors too.
But we don't necessarily exercise our power as shareholders enough at the moment.
Let's talk about that. A typical director of a company has a personal life. And almost certainly, if you're a director of a company, you go home, you're going to do something nice and green at the weekend, fishing, or you might be going bushwalking, you'll go out in the environment. The kids of those people are passionately green, with few exceptions, because they're third generation wealthy people who actually understand the world. They love the beauty of the place. And ultimately, that conversation over the breakfast table changes the minds of those shareholders and directors, and they all come home. Now, I was working with a very large financial company, the second biggest merchant bank in the world, actually, and I had all the partners locked up in a place in Sunshine Coast quite recently, and they said, we would like to become part of the solution to climate change. Can you help me? Help us. Now, I asked them why. He says, we're all green at home, and we come to work, and we're brown at work. Now, I can't live with that inconsistency anymore. I cannot live with that inconsistency anymore in my life. I actually have to... I want to be able to be proud of what I do at work so I can tell my even greener children that they can look at me as a green hero. I am sick of apologising for my corporate performance to my children. And they are asking embarrassing questions because they all go to the best schools and the best universities and they are very demanding critics of my life. Now, I've heard that story in 100 versions. I've heard it up to top CEOs.
Really?
And I actually talk to CEOs and I say, and this is another thing, we talk about a powerful CEO. John D. Rockefeller was a robber baron for 40-odd years in oil, but in the last 5 years of his life, he set up the Rockefeller Foundation, where he gave a lot of it back, and he still is. Everyone's forgotten about the first 40 years, and they don't remember the last five. Now, he thought about legacy. Every powerful man or woman reaching to the end of their life thinks about legacy. And I ask my CEOs, you're dead. How are your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren remembering you? In one sentence. Are we rich and powerful as a robber baron? I don't think so. They want to be proud. And so, as you actually say, one comes back to one's responsibility to society, to the community, and now to planet as well. As one gets, so the richer and powerful, more powerful you are, the stronger this issue of legacy becomes on people. Now, this is a global change, affected what when you were small minorities of people, but now with a huge extended middle class, educated middle class, are people who will like you and criticise you and go to clubs with you and play golf with you and play tennis with you and go to the opera with you, whatever you do. Those conversations are often around the world society. And the fact is that saving our planetary home has now become the big issue, not only in terms of ecological systems, but in terms of justice, in terms of intercultural tolerance, and a whole lot of other important issues, which I could go and I've written about in my new book in great detail. But the important point about that is those are the issues. We need a harmonious, sustainable, interculturally tolerant, equitable kind of planet. And we actually have to be... It's a spaceship, planetary spaceship, isn't it? Spaceship Earth, I've talked about that with you before. And we're all cosmonauts in that spaceship, and we have to behave like crew members on this spaceship, and we have to get our spaceship through to the next destination, which is a place which is even better, perhaps, today for our grandchildren and great-grandchildren than it is for us and all the other species on the planet. Now, that's an issue of global responsibility, which is now dominating mindsets. And as a futurist, I work on the evolving mindsets. That's what I mostly do, because the future is created by the values of the emerging powerful groups and the emerging... If I want to know what the world would be like in 2020, I mostly talk to the kids and what their values are, and I look about projecting the future and the whole issues around that. And I can predict pretty much what those value systems are. And as you know, I've written a whole set on planetary values. They are now shaping the planet, whether you like it or not. And I call those the planetist mindset, and there are 9 value shifts in that.
I heard a term the other day, a metaphysical mutation, by some guy called Michel Houellebecq. But apparently he was talking about how, yeah, similar sort of thing, these mindsets that take hold, and it's a mutation of the way that we fundamentally think and believe.
It's a change in our knowledge and perception of ourselves and other.
A great idea whose time has come and can't be, nothing can get in the way of it.
Well, that's interesting, because let's talk about that and coming back to wealth.
Buckminster, then let's have some lunch.
Yeah. Buckminster Fuller said, wealth consists of two elements, the physical, i.e. materials, which must be conserved. He said this in 1970, by the way. The physical, which must be conserved, and the metaphysical, i.e. knowledge, which can only grow. And wealth increasing less of the physical stuff and more of the metaphysical stuff. So as the metaphysical realm changes and is changed rapidly by these kind of gestalt shifts in metaphysical perceptions about people, about our knowledge about... Because metaphysics is basically, what do we know? I mean, it's interesting if you look at the three branches of philosophy. Metaphysics, what do we know? Epistemology, how do we know? And ethics, what should we do? All three are wrapped around this whole issue. What do we know? How do we know it? How do we know it? We see the planet, the spaceship Earth. How do we know? We know we have a planetary home. That moment of Earthrise said, we now perceive the planet. Now that's built in and built in and grown over several generations. And now we've come to the third range of ethics. What should we do? So those three pillars of philosophy are now working together in our knowledge realm to change our behaviour. So what we know, how we know, and what we have to do as a result is the whole story. And the middle-class people, educated middle-class people in the world, do more thinking about that. And they've come to the conclusion that their planet's in danger with current things. We are being unsustainable. We know our current behaviour is unsustainable. We wish we could have a sustainable future. If we can picture what a sustainable future is, we can actually then say, well, that's what we've got to become. And what are all the new innovations, both physical innovations and social innovations, we need to create? And that's the 21st century economy we're talking about. That's all happening today. And it all comes back to the arrival of planetism as a consciousness, as a core consciousness to say, my planetary home is basically all I've got. Nations are irrelevant by comparison. And as we get used to that idea, being an Australian, so we don't cease to be Australians. We celebrate our Australianness in a new and different way, don't we? We don't deny Australianness or Americanness or whatever it is, or our cultural background or our tribal rate, but we perceive it as a subset of a bigger obligation, which is the planet. So, and then we create all these new forms of
it's like I don't have to stop being a Riley to be an Australian.
No,
Melbournean to be an Australian.
Well, I mean, the whole so-called world industries. You think about world music. It's tribal music, but sung together as a celebration of cultural diversity. So it's about tribal and planetary at the same time. And you go into a big food hall, which I call a world food hall, and that food hall consists of 25 different cuisines, and you have one course from each of them, don't you? You're celebrating the world's cuisines in a single place. That's very postmodern, that's very planetist. You celebrate difference, but at the same time you are part of unity. That is the story of the 20th century in a nutshell.
We've got to do one of these on video someday, man. People need to see how animated you are when you talk about this. The passion, I don't think, the audio recording doesn't do the passion justice. Next one we're going to do on video. I did have that little video up from the modem spinning thing. It was great.
Yeah.
But just you and me like this. I mean, next one we'll do on video, right? That's it. You want some lunch?
Yeah.
We're going to break for lunch, kids. We may or may not be back. I'm not sure.
We didn't come back.